This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, bringing you vital information to boost your health, your finances, and your rights. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review, all things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Libby Znaimer. The dry January challenge is in full swing, but what about a more relaxed version? This year, damp January is becoming a thing. And in a searing memoir, former BC Cabinet Minister Selena Robinson blames her ouster on the explosion of anti-Semitism after October the 7th, in the NDP in particular. But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. Canadians have the seventh most powerful passport in the world. This according to the Henley Passport Index, which ranks the world's passports according to the number of destinations their holders can access without a visa. The index compares visa-free access of 199 different passports to 227 travel destinations. Singapore remains the most powerful passport in the world. European countries dominate the top 10. France, Germany, Italy, and Spain are in third position. And Canada is in a better position than the U.S., which now sits in the ninth spot after dropping seven places in the last decade. It's not a visa requirement, but starting this week, Canadians visiting the U.K. for short trips will need to get something called an electronic travel authorization, or ETA, before boarding their flight. It's a new digital travel requirement for individuals who don't need a visa to enter the UK, and it'll cost you $18. The team behind the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID jab has developed a vaccine for the bubonic plague. The scientists report good results in trials as military experts say the UK should stockpile supplies of the Black Death inoculation. Three of the world's seven known pandemics have been caused by the plague, which is a bacterial infection that can be treated with antibiotics. But throughout history, the plague has killed around 200 million people worldwide. 91-year-old U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley has just been sworn in as Senate President pro tempore, making him third in line to the presidency. The position goes to the longest-serving senator of the majority party. Grassley says he's ready to serve as president in the unlikely event he's called. And he's not the oldest senator in the role. That title belongs to Republican Strom Thurmond, who served at 98, 24 years ago. Researchers in the Netherlands published the names of about 425,000 people who were investigated on suspicion of collaborating with German occupiers during the Second World War. It's part of a project called War in Court. The names are part of an archive of files from the Special Jurisdiction, a legal system set up in 1944 to bring Nazi collaborators to justice after the Allies liberated the Netherlands from German occupation. I'm Libby Znaimer, and those are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. It was officially launched as a campaign in the UK in 2013. Since then, Dry January, the challenge of going alcohol-free, has become popular around the world. Now a new alternative of a damp January is gaining traction. I spoke with public health physician Dr. Barry Pacus.
For some people, a dry January is a great idea, a marker in time where they can, and along with other people, think about just abstaining from whatever it might be in service of their health, and in this case, alcohol. And that helps them do that because people are doing it together. There's this social expectation, and complete abstinence makes sense for some people. For other people, particularly with alcohol, complete abstinence does not make sense at all. And this is part of what we talk about when we talk about harm reduction strategies. We know that some people are not going to be able to abstain. And with alcohol, there are many people who don't want to abstain entirely. They want to keep alcohol as part of sort of a social thing, but not have many of the negative, very negative consequences of alcohol. So a damp January seems like a reasonable thing where the goal is just to, whatever you're doing the last year, just cut down a notch in service of your health for the future year.
What about somebody who drinks one or two glasses?
So one or two glasses a day still is a lot, and for two reasons. One is, and it differs between males and females, but the new guidance really has really dramatically reduced what we think is low risk. And there's low risk from a cancer perspective, which is something new that I hope we can talk about. And then there's also this low risk from all kinds of other perspectives, cardiovascular, heart health, liver health, the potential for motor vehicle accidents, that sort of thing. And it's gone down from maybe one drink a day for women, two drinks a day for men would be lower risk or in theory safe, right down to, you know, it may only be two or three drinks in a week that would be considered low risk.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. It comes as the U.S. Surgeon General has said he wants warning labels on alcohol because of the risk of cancer and the idea that there's no safe level of drinking. I mean, is it really worth cracking down on that to that extent?
Messaging isn't necessarily cracking down, and I want to emphasize that in Canada, we've been talking about this for a long time, putting warning labels on alcohol because of the cancer risk, because we know with 100% certainty that alcohol does cause cancer, but it does so the way many things cause cancer. It's on a spectrum, right? There's no safe level because any amount has a little bit of cancer-causing capacity, but only when you're doing, using a lot of it is it most certainly going to cause cancer in any one individual. But we know on a population level, because alcohol is consumed by so many people so regularly, that if we look at a population health level, a lot of the cancers, some have estimated 10 to even 15% of cancers are actually caused by alcohol use, 7,000 cancers potentially in a year or more. So, it's a matter of that most people don't actually know that alcohol does cause cancer. And one of the ways to let them know so that they can make decisions about their own health is to put labels on bottles.
I have a regular medical panel on Wednesdays, and the consensus among them about dry January is they're saying, at the end of the day, what's the value of doing something for a month? And they're all kind of dubious. They're saying you should be doing things that will result in long-term change. In your opinion, what's the value of doing a January thing?
There's no question, I think, as an individual clinician and from a public health perspective, doing something for short-term has lots of benefits. So, it would, first of all, help you understand whether you think you have a problem. For some people, if you attempt to abstain or decrease and you're physically, emotionally, mentally, or socially truly not able to do that, for many people, that could be a wake-up call in and of itself, right? Another thing is, if you're successful in getting off alcohol, just like smoking and a number of other things, you might feel worse for a short period of time, but you might feel a lot better. In particular, alcohol's effect on sleep, for example. If you reduce alcohol, even for a few days, it will allow more consistent REM sleep, the deep sleep, less fragmented sleep, and you might feel, after a couple days, better mood, better energy, and then more motivated to actually abstain or decrease for a longer period of time. And, those sorts of effects that you might see, either how hard it is or how great it is, even if you're abstaining for a short amount of time just in January, that really might provide you the incentive you need to go forward and make a permanent change.
Anything else you want to leave us with?
I think the overall approach to alcohol that we have now is really important to think about in a damp January. It, you know, helps us understand that whatever you're drinking, any amount that you're drinking right now, it really is important to just think about decreasing it, no matter what level you're using right now, because there are these new, very clear impacts on health. So, you know, I hope everyone would take that to heart a little bit.
Okay. Dr. Barry Pacus, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was public health physician Dr. Barry Pacus, who is with the Dalhousie School of Public Health. I'm Libby Znaimer, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. Coming up, a searing memoir of anti-Semitism in the NDP from ousted BC Cabinet Minister Selena Robinson.
You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting for financial security for our seniors. Find out more at carp.ca.
It was an unfortunate choice of words that led to an outsized consequence. Former BC Cabinet Minister Selena Robinson was ousted from her job painfully and publicly, after referring to the land Israel was founded on as a crappy piece of land. She says she was targeted because she is Jewish, and her experience highlights the explosion of anti-Semitism around the world and inside the NDP in particular.
I set out to write Truth Be Told because I really felt it was important that people understand the rise in anti-Semitism that we are seeing, not just in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, but frankly, globally, is a real problem, I believe, for democracy, especially when governments cave to what I think is whether it's political pressure or manipulation by people who are protesting. That's what essentially happened to me. And I think we need to stand up for our democracy. We need to do that together.
So let's go back to your story. In the aftermath of October the 7th, you were on a panel and you described Israel or Palestine before Israel as a crappy piece of land, and that led to your losing your job and also losing your community with the NDP government.
Yeah, so I called myself lovingly the Jew in the crew. I've been a strong Jewish voice in our government since 2017. I've been tasked with sort of being the liaison with the Jewish community, and certainly after October 7th, that became a much more important and more prominent role, trying to support the community and making sure government understood the fear, the level of fear that people were experiencing, the grief that they were feeling, and certainly, you know, the fire bombings and the shooting at schools and all of that has certainly, you know, was coming to the forefront. My statement was not about the people, it's about the kind of land, the quality of land. But certainly the haters decided that I needed to be brought down, and I believe they decided to bring me down well before I made that comment. They were just waiting for some opportunity. But what was heartbreaking was that my government, my premier, and my colleagues decided that it was worthwhile to have me stripped of my cabinet responsibilities because they felt that I had somehow breached the idea that we shouldn't talk about anti-Semitism or we shouldn't talk about the conflict. And to me, that's just incomprehensible that any government, particularly a progressive government, would not be interested in engaging in dialogue about what was happening.
Okay, let's go back to what you said. At first, it seemed like your government had your back, but that changed pretty quickly.
Yeah, the comment I got from the premier was a text. I sent him a text started apologizing, saying I didn't mean to create this kind of disturbance because, you know, on social media, people were losing their minds, calling me all sorts of names, not paying attention to the context in which I was speaking. Certainly, Muslim associations were calling for my head. So the message I got from the premier was, don't worry, happens to the best of us. Over the weekend that transpired, got much more heated. My party was forced to cancel a fundraiser, and there were certainly protests at a caucus meeting that we were to be having. And the premier decided perhaps I should resign, and basically forced me to resign. The thing that surprised me the most, I have to say, Libby, is the silence of my colleagues. I worked really hard with these people for a decade. These are my friends. And
They were your friends.
They were my friends.
I don't think they are anymore.
No. There were a couple that would say to me, Selena, you know, our colleagues don't understand the anti-Semitism. They do not understand the impact of what this is having. And they were just pretending like it was all okay. And I was stunned by their silence.
What's your view of anti-Semitism on the left these days?
I would say I've only seen it in the federal NDP much more prominently than the provincial NDP. We're related, but not the same. At the federal NDP, I certainly saw lots of it in earlier years. The number of resolutions at their annual conventions or biannual conventions, it's overwhelmingly, you know, they hate Israel. Israel is an abomination based on just the number of resolutions. They have more resolutions against Israel than they do for China, Iran, North Korea combined. And I've tried, and others have tried, to say to the federal party, take a chill pill. Israel is not a perfect democracy. It has challenges. And yes, you can have one or two resolutions asking them to do better, demanding that they do better. But this is ridiculous. This is an obsession. And the federal party sort of refused to respond. It's played out on the left, on the extreme left, using this anti-colonial framework that we've been talking about here in Canada, and overlaying it in Israel, when it's a false narrative to do that. It's not. It's completely inappropriate to do that. If this was any other minority group, I would expect all of our leaders to say, not on our watch, because this is not who we are. So when I hear, you know, Justin Trudeau or Doug Meek or Pierre Poilievre saying, this is not who we are, okay, fine, then shut it down. But no one is shutting it down, right? We are seeing it right across. We're seeing it in Ontario that has a conservative government. We're seeing it here in BC that has a new Democrat government. And it's And nothing's changed. So this isn't a problem of left or right. This is a problem of leadership. And we need a leader. We need leaders who will just say no and deal with it by addressing our laws and enforcing our laws and giving direction to our police force that we expect you to take action on these very hateful activities and to address it properly. And no one's doing that.
Selena Robinson, thanks for this, and thank you for sharing your story. I'm sorry you had to go through this.
Thank you very much for having me, and the book is available on Amazon.
Okay. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That was former BC Cabinet Minister Selena Robinson. Her memoir is called Truth Be Told. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Libby Znaimer. Thanks for joining me today. Be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Zeev Hadi and Christine Ross, with technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Znaimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.